50 years ago this week, President Dwight Eisenhower delivered an address to the UN General Assembly that became known as the Atoms for Peace speech. He proposed a grand atomic bargain. In exchange for not developing nuclear weapons, the nations of the world could benefit from the peaceful applications of atomic energy. A half century later, the international system that emerged to implement that bargain is under severe strain. NPR's Mike Schuster has the second of two reports on the Atoms for Peace program.
On December 8, 1953, President Dwight Eisenhower launched the world into the era of nuclear arms control and civilian nuclear power.
The United States knows that if the fearful trend of atomic military buildup can be reversed, this greatest of destructive forces can be developed into a great boom for the benefit of all mankind.
It was a proposal that would give rise to a complex international fabric of institutions and agreements. The International Atomic Energy Agency, created in 1957, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty a decade later, nuclear safeguard agreements with more than 180 nations, export controls, U.S.-Soviet arms control treaties, and much more. At the time of Eisenhower's speech, the Nuclear Weapons Club had just two members, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. China, France, and Great Britain soon joined, then came Israel, and later India and Pakistan. Were it not for the international non-proliferation system, there could have been many more, says physicist Sidney Drell of Stanford University, who has played a key advisory role on these issues to many U.S. presidents.
Non-use of nuclear weapons is accepted. Non-possession is widely accepted, and only 8 countries out of 189 have nuclear weapons. So the nuclear level is far less than was predicted.
But in the last 12 years, the world has been forced to deal with nuclear cheaters, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. All nations that accepted the deal, signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, put their civilian nuclear programs under international safeguards, and then secretly used that technology to pursue nuclear weapons. Why now? Why didn't this happen decades ago? Siegfried Hecker, former director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, believes the answer lies in both the supply of and the demand for nuclear technology. Atoms for Peace certainly expanded the supply, Hecker says.
The opportunity to get weapons-related knowledge, the opportunity to get your hands on the nuclear materials that are actually required to make nuclear weapons, had increased steadily over that whole time. And I think to some extent one has to say what Atoms for Peace did was accelerate that process.
The technology that produces fissionable material, highly enriched uranium and plutonium, has also advanced, become smaller, more efficient, and easier to hide. But the demand side has changed as well. The Cold War helped to keep demand down, says Hecker. Perhaps an irony of history, the end of the Cold War brought less international security.
Whereas before, the two superpowers, to some extent, provided the checks and balances. That balance is lost, and so some countries might feel less protected, and therefore their demand side goes up.
That was certainly the case with North Korea, gradually abandoned by its allies, the Soviet Union and China, in the late 1980s. And in the case of Iraq and Iran, both began to pursue nuclear weapons during the devastating war they fought against each other in the 1980s. Iraq was caught first, a result of the 1991 Gulf War. In that war's aftermath, it became clear that the International Atomic Energy Agency, which had inspected Iraq's declared civilian nuclear program, was unable to ferret out nuclear cheating. The agency needed new tools, says John Holum, former Undersecretary of State for Arms Control.
It's not the fault of the IAEA, it's the fault of the countries that designed the system, which was designed to safeguard only peaceful nuclear sites, and they do a very good job of that. If you have a declared nuclear power plant, the IAEA can inspect the fuel, can maintain strict accounting to make sure that no fuel is being diverted, but they haven't had any right to inspect away from declared sites.
After the Gulf War, the UN Security Council told the IAEA it could inspect anywhere in Iraq, and the agency effectively dismantled Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. Later in the 1990s, the nations comprising the IAEA's Board of Governors gave it the right, known as the Additional Protocol, to conduct more intrusive inspections, to go anywhere in a nation suspected of nuclear cheating, even to military installations. Most nations have yet to agree to this beefed-up inspection regime, but with its extensive cheating recently revealed, Iran says it will now accept the Additional Protocol. North Korea has broken out altogether, publicly declaring its intention to acquire a nuclear arsenal, and urgent international diplomatic efforts are underway to persuade it to abandon that path. The cheating has convinced many in the Bush administration that urgent changes are necessary if the world is to contain this problem. This is John Bolton, current Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, speaking in Washington last week.
One would have to ask, knowing what we know today about proliferation when we were starting the Atoms for Peace program 50 years ago, whether we would have done it the same way if we had seen the way that it played out. And I think there are a lot of suggestions out there that we're certainly actively considering for changes in the non-proliferation treaty itself.
But the Bush administration has demonstrated a penchant for unilateral military action at the same time that it has promulgated a nuclear policy of its own, supporting research into new uses of nuclear weapons. That approach has Sidney Drell of Stanford University greatly concerned.
If we really want to encourage other countries not to go nuclear and to honor the Non-Proliferation Treaty, I find it troubling that we at this stage are now talking about maybe we need new weapons for limited nuclear missions, which have nothing to do with deterrence, as I know it, with the so-called bunker busters. That is a message to the rest of the world. If we need them, they do too.
So many experts have begun to worry that Atoms for Peace may no longer be such a good idea. Siegfried Hecker, former director of Los Alamos, disagrees.
Is the deal or Eisenhower's dream still appropriate today? And the answer, in my opinion, is most certainly yes. The need for electricity, especially in the developing world, is so immense. And at least as I look at the next 100 or so years, the only reliable source from which the electricity can come, which is also environmentally acceptable, is nuclear power.
Hecker and others are convinced, though, that all the instruments to control the spread of nuclear weapons must be strengthened. Greater export controls, new international systems that can prevent nuclear technology from reaching unstable nations, interdiction of dangerous nuclear materials on the high seas, a favorite of the Bush administration, and much more concerted action on the part of the five leading nuclear powers, which are also the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. This requires the most urgent attention of the world's leaders, says Sidney Drell.
With 58 years since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we have not used that weapon, even though countries like the United States and the former Soviet Union were engaged in otherwise unwinnable wars. We have created a very important norm, and we certainly want to save that.
Without improvements in this non-proliferation system, the world may not be as free of nuclear attack in the coming years as it has been since President Eisenhower proposed Atoms for Peace 50 years ago. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Los Angeles.